Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to our episodes early and ad-free and get access to monthly exclusive episodes. Go to patreon.com/madnesspod. We've got links in our show notes.
The opinions expressed in the following episode do not necessarily reflect those of the Minds of Madness podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Imagine stepping out to your mailbox one morning, only to discover an envelope addressed to you from a notorious serial killer who's been locked away since the 80s. Inside the envelope, you're relieved not to find any grisly mementos, but instead find a birthday card for your infant child, along with a handwritten message complimenting you on your beautiful family. Some might argue that such a message would be just as horrifying as receiving a severed finger or lock of hair. Either way, for most people, receiving anything in the mail from a serial killer would be abnormal. But that wasn't the case with Rex and Amanda Taylor. For them, getting letters from serial killers was actually quite normal and something they looked forward to. Richard Ramirez, the infamous Night Stalker, had sent them a similar card after developing a long-distance friendship with the couple after years of correspondence. Only in hindsight can we say this particular relationship seemed to embody the proverb, "Show me your friends, and I'll show you your future." Join me now as we look into the chilling story of Amanda Taylor, a young wife whose fascination with horror and murder ended up taking a dark turn in her own life. You'll hear how what started out as a hobby eventually evolved into dangerous fantasies and secrets, fueled by the perilous mixture of mental illness and familial conflicts, ultimately creating a powder keg that ended in savage murder. If you're a true crime enthusiast, you've likely heard the name Charles Starkweather, who in 1958 embarked on a deadly killing spree across Nebraska and Wyoming. And along with him was his 14-year-old girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, claiming the lives of 11 victims along the way. Even if these names don't immediately sound familiar, you've probably at least heard the romanticized legend of their story. A young couple in love recklessly defying society as they went on a senseless rampage. A dark legend that inspired a number of artistic works, from Bruce Springsteen's song Nebraska to dozens of fictionalized books and movies based upon the Starkweather spree. Perhaps there's no more famous example than the Oliver Stone 1994 film Natural Born Killers, a movie that follows the characters of Mickey and Mallory Knox, damaged outcasts who fall in love and begin a ruthless killing spree across America. Today, there's an entire Wikipedia page dedicated to chronicling the number of copycat crimes allegedly inspired by Natural Born Killers. One of them we covered in episode 109. And so, we're left with this complicated web of homicidal inception, copycats of copycats, inspired by a movie that was inspired by real life, with the Starkweather spree in 1958 as a sort of ground zero for it all. Ironically, Natural Born Killers aimed to criticize the media's obsession with violence, but clearly, not all the viewers absorbed that message. For a young couple in Christiansburg, Virginia, watching Mickey and Mallory Knox inspired them to become a modern-day version of the doomed lovers on screen. To them, the film was more of an inspiration than a critique. After meeting in high school at 14 and 16 years old, Amanda and Rex became convinced they were meant for each other, that their destinies were intertwined. Aside from being instantly attracted to each other, Amanda and Rex also discovered they had something else in common, a cosmic coincidence that would come to hold a special meaning for the couple. They were both born on the same day, March 27th, which ironically, I'm recording on this day, Wednesday, March 27th, and I didn't plan that. For Rex and Amanda, this was a sign from the universe, solidifying they were meant for each other, with 327 becoming their day, their special number. And Rex would reinforce that every day by sending sweet messages to Amanda at exactly 3:27 a.m. or p.m. For Amanda, meeting a guy like Rex and having a stable relationship seemed almost too good to be true. She'd only moved to Virginia from Florida a few years earlier, and since then, stability in her life had been in short supply. For starters, Amanda never met her biological father, who reportedly went to prison on homicide charges shortly before she was born. Then, not long after moving to Virginia, Amanda's mother was required to return to Florida to serve a short prison sentence for an unrelated offense. Fortunately for Amanda, she and her sister were able to stay in Virginia, moving in with an uncle who looked after them, and he became a father figure in Amanda's life. But as Amanda became a teen, she started exhibiting signs of self-harming behavior and suicidal ideations. Trying to help Amanda, her family checked her into a psychiatric hospital. After finishing her prison sentence, Amanda's mother noticed a change in her daughter, saying she seemed to have drifted away from her. That Amanda seemed angry with her. She said she could tell Amanda needed a positive role model in her life, somebody she knew she couldn't be for her. But despite all the challenges Amanda faced growing up, she never described her childhood in a negative light, even claiming she had a perfect life, surrounded by family who loved and supported her. Around the age of 12, Amanda met the person who'd become her lifelong best friend, her classmate, Mariah Roebuck. 2 years after meeting, the 14-year-olds even tried running away from home together by taking a car without permission. Although they didn't get far before police tracked them down, the girls would pull the same stunt 2 years later when they were 16. It was also Mariah who introduced Amanda to Rex Taylor, the man of her dreams.
There are certain things about the aging process that I think most women are willing to embrace, like the wisdom and experience it brings. But for me, there are a couple things I'm not about to embrace, especially if it can be avoided, and that's my hair thinning, which I first started to notice when I got into my 40s. And not just thinning, but it wasn't growing either. What I didn't realize was the cause of this wasn't just because I was getting older. There were a whole bunch of other things contributing to it, like the daily stresses of parenting, skipping meals, not getting the proper amount of sleep, just to name a few. And what was happening to my hair was just one of the indicators that I needed something that would not only support my hair growth, but my overall health as well. So I started taking Nutrafol, which is not only the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, but a supplement that takes a whole body approach to hair health, addressing the problems inside to help hair grow on the outside, supporting your lifestyle, not just your hairstyle. After taking Nutrafol for 3 months, I've not only noticed an improvement in the overall appearance and growth of my hair, but I noticed an improvement in my mood and energy level as well. And with Nutrafol, building a hair growth routine is simple. No trips to the pharmacy or forgetting to buy more. Just make your purchase online and then it'll get shipped to your door free, with automated deliveries ensuring you'll never miss a day. Take your first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering Minds of Madness listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code MADNESS. Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code MADNESS.
Although Amanda and Rex always believed they were bonded by their shared birthday, it was actually another birthday that would guarantee the couple would remain connected forever. When Amanda found out she was pregnant with Rex's child at 15 years old. After deciding to keep the baby, Amanda dropped out of school at 17 and officially tied the knot with Rex when he was 19 in 2007. For the next few years, Amanda and Rex took turns living at each other's parents' houses. When they stayed at Rex's home, they lived with his father, Charles Taylor, and Rex's grandfather. According to Amanda, although Charles was nothing but wonderful to her and the baby, she observed a strange dynamic when it came to him and his son, Rex. To her, it appeared that Rex and Charles were more like party buddies than father and son. And what she meant by party buddies was that Charles supplied Rex with drugs, specifically painkillers. Both Charles and his father had prescriptions for various opiate pills, and according to Amanda, to earn extra cash, Charles allegedly sold them on the black market for around $80 apiece, a fairly common side hustle in a place like Montgomery County, Virginia, where nearly a quarter of the population lives below the poverty level. Although Amanda claims Charles never took these pills recreationally himself, she'd later say Charles started giving them to Rex when he was about 13 years old. Like Amanda, Rex too struggled with his own mental health and feelings of depression at times. And she claimed his father introduced him to pills as a misguided attempt to help medicate his son. By the time Rex and Amanda were married with a baby, Rex was essentially a functioning addict who was rarely seen completely sober. And no matter how many times Amanda pleaded with Charles to stop giving Rex pills, she claims he never would. Eventually, Amanda and Rex were able to move into their own home together, and in 2012, they welcomed their second child. When Rex and Amanda were together, those who knew them best describe a couple that was desperately in love with each other, who would do anything for each other. Besides getting married, having children, and sharing the same birthday, there was one particular interest Rex and Amanda shared that solidified their inseparability. A fascination, perhaps you could even say, an obsession for all things horror. Music, art, video games, and of course, true crime. But it wasn't the detectives, victims, or justice system that really captured their interest. It was the perpetrators themselves, and the more twisted, the better. Together, Amanda and Rex explored the darkest corners of the internet, even becoming connected with various online communities with people who shared similar interests, forums, blogs, and websites dedicated to murderabilia. Soon they realized they weren't alone in their interests in the darker side of human nature, and that thousands of other people from around the world also shared the same morbid curiosity. To take it even a step further, Rex and Amanda also began writing letters to their favorite serial killers, hoping to become pen pals. And it didn't take long before the couple were in regular correspondence with a number of United States' most notorious killers. So much so, they even started considering them friends. With Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, remembering to send cards for Amanda and Rex's children's birthday. But there was one particular predator Rex became close to while corresponding through the mail, and that was a serial killer from Chicago who was responsible for 7 known rapes and murders, though he was suspected for many more. His name was Paul Runge, a name you probably remember because we just covered him in episode 205. And Amanda and Rex just didn't consider him a friend. They considered the infamous death row inmate part of their family. 1 year for her birthday, Paul sent Amanda a drawing he made. It depicted a cover of Newsweek magazine with Paul and Amanda's mugshots together, a direct homage to a scene from Natural Born Killers where Mickey and Mallory Knox's mugshots made the cover. In the drawing, Amanda Taylor's mugshot placard actually reads A. Knox, and the caption reads, America examines its values in the aftermath of the P&A killings. But what was it about Paul that gave him such a special significance in Rex and Amanda's eyes? Without seeing the actual letters, we'll never know for sure, but we did come across one aspect of Paul's killing spree, and that was Paul Runge hadn't acted alone. He had a partner in crime, his wife Charlene. According to Amanda, this had been something she'd fantasized about doing with Rex, going on some kind of killing spree together. Talking about it, dreaming about it, and actually believing one day they'd make it happen. Rex and Amanda even gave themselves serial killer nicknames, with Rex's nickname being the Blacksburg Butcher and Amanda's the Brunette Bomber. Not only could they be like Paul Runge and his wife, but they could also be just like Mickey and Mallory Knox from Natural Born Killers, a movie Amanda described that her and Rex were obsessed with. Despite Amanda and Rex seeming completely perfect for each other, there was also still one major elephant in the room, Rex's addiction to pills. And in April 2014, it came to a breaking point. It happened one day when Rex almost crashed his car while driving under the influence of pills, with both of his children in the car. And at that point, Amanda drew a line in the sand, kicking Rex out of their home. But it wasn't goodbye forever. Amanda made it clear she still loved him and wanted to be with him, but not until he got himself clean and sober. Having nowhere else to go, Rex moved back with his father, Charles, and from there, his addiction and depression only grew worse. 4 months later, on the day of their son's 7th birthday, Rex took his own life by hanging himself in his father's shed. A devastating loss to all who knew and loved him. And Rex's death also marked the beginning of an escalating feud between Charles and Amanda. She blamed Charles personally for Rex's death, for getting him addicted in the first place, and then continuing to enable his addiction, even after it was clear Rex had a serious problem. But Charles blamed Rex's depression on Amanda for kicking him out and taking his children away. Evidence of the conflict between Amanda and Rex's family is even evident in Rex's obituary, which very obviously does not include Amanda's name among the other members of his family, including his children and some friends that he was survived by. In the wake of Rex's suicide, Amanda sank into a deep, dark spiral of depression herself. Amanda's mother would later say, Amanda never grieved over it or anything. Her eyes just went empty. She changed. It wasn't her. People did try their best to cheer her up. Paul Runge even sent Amanda a gift of $1,000 from prison to express his condolences. But the only real source of comfort for Amanda came from her closest friends, Mariah and her husband, Johnny Roebuck. Trying to pull herself out of her mental health spiral, Amanda started spending a considerable amount of time over at the Roebuck's house, which is where she ended up meeting the Roebuck's roommate, 32-year-old Sean Ball, who lived in their basement. Soon the two of them began spending quite a bit of time together, and Sean started developing feelings for Amanda. As they got to know each other, Sean told Amanda he was ex-military, ex-special forces, that he spent time overseas as a sniper in Afghanistan and had killed a man in combat. Learning about Amanda's darker interests, Sean believed she'd be impressed by a bona fide killer like himself. But the feelings between Sean and Amanda weren't mutual. In fact, behind Sean's back, Amanda would tell Mariah how much she loathed him. Still, Amanda decided to string Sean along, realizing quickly she could easily manipulate him into doing basically whatever she wanted. On one occasion, she even told Mariah, "I can control him like he's a dog." As Sean became more obsessed with Amanda, Amanda continued keeping him on the proverbial leash. And according to Sean, She hadn't just been leading him on with her words.
I really felt like she and I kind of loved each other. She might have actually been pregnant too, so I kind of felt in the protector role of her. I got so obsessed with her and just wanted to be there for her all the time, was because everything she said was like something I've always wanted to hear from somebody. Like, I've never felt good enough for anyone. She just made me feel important. I was that guy that she was waiting for since her husband died.
It would turn out that Amanda was not in fact pregnant from Sean. Instead, it seemed she'd used the possibility as a way to further manipulate him. And soon, Sean would reveal just how far he was willing to go to truly win Amanda's affections. March 27th, 2015 was Amanda's 24th birthday. Hoping to cheer her up and show her a good time, Mariah, Johnny, and Sean all took her out for some drinks to celebrate. But as the night wore on, the celebration turned to mourning. Because it wasn't just Amanda's birthday. That day should have been Rex's birthday as well. Eventually, Amanda convinced them to go visit Rex's grave in the middle of the night. Mariah and Johnny knew nothing good could possibly come of it, but she was the birthday girl, and they felt like they couldn't refuse. Moments later, they wished they had. Standing over Rex's gravestone, Amanda pulled a large knife out of her purse and attempted to slit her throat. She was saved at the last second when Mariah tackled her to the ground and wrestled the knife away. It took all of her friends to drag Amanda away from the cemetery and back to her mother's house, kicking and screaming all the way. Amanda's stepfather, William, recalled what happened next.
2:30 in the morning, there's a knock at the door. She's out there fighting this Sean and Mariah and Mariah's husband. And she's got a knife saying it was her birthday and it was Rex's birthday too. And she said it was their day and she was going to be with him. Well, she broke and ran. And the police caught her somewhere going down Radford Street. Well, they took her to St. Albans.
Amanda was committed to a local psychiatric facility under a temporary detention order for 72 hours. There, her friends and family told the hospital about her suicide attempt, as well as other threats she'd made, including a desire to kill her own children. Their hope was that the hospital would extend her commitment period well beyond the 72 hours. It was obvious Amanda needed some serious help and observation, and Amanda's mother was given the impression they would keep her for at least 30 days. Tragically, this would not be the case. And as soon as Amanda was legally allowed to leave, she attempted to check herself out. But there was one problem. The hospital wouldn't release Amanda unless a responsible party was willing to take custody of her. Amanda called her mother, begging for someone to come pick her up. But her mother refused, knowing it was in Amanda's best interest to remain at the facility. She then called Mariah and Johnny Roebuck, but they refused for the same reasons. Everyone who loved Amanda and wanted to see her truly get well knew she needed treatment that only a hospital could provide. So then Amanda called Sean Ball, the one person she knew would always do anything she wanted. When Sean got the call from Amanda, he was in the middle of his shift at Applebee's. But without hesitation, he dropped everything he was doing and raced to the hospital to get her out. His plan was to bring her back to Mariah and Johnny's house, where he was still living in the basement. But as soon as they found out, they were livid and kicked him out of their house on the spot. That night, Sean and Amanda stayed in a motel together. And soon, they started planning their next move. By this time, Sean was already well aware of Amanda's natural-born killer's obsession. So when Amanda started telling him how she wanted to become a real-life version of Mickey and Mallory, he liked the sound of it. After all, if Amanda was supposed to be Mallory in this scenario, by default, that would mean he would get to be Mickey, her lover. And from Amanda's standpoint, involving Sean meant that her partner in crime would be a legitimate war veteran who was no stranger to killing people.
Her plan was she wanted to do like a true mass murder spree. Like she talked about going down the road and shooting at people or stopping at truck stops. And like when people aren't looking or something like that, she would just shoot or stab them.
It seemed Amanda felt this was her chance to finally live out the fantasy she'd always imagined carrying out with Rex. And just like natural-born killers, Amanda didn't plan on starting her killing spree with random strangers. On April 3rd, 2015, Sean drove Amanda to his parents' house to pick up some of his personal belongings. He also snuck into his father's gun safe and stole a hunting rifle and two handguns. Sean then went out and bought Amanda a large bayonet-style knife. Again, the same woman who put a knife to her throat a week earlier. The next morning, Amanda and Sean went over to the home of Charles Taylor, Rex's father. He'd offered to give Amanda some money so she could buy his grandchildren Easter baskets full of goodies. It seemed as if he'd been able to put some of their bad blood behind him. Or perhaps this was his way of extending an olive branch in Amanda's direction. But any notions of repairing their fractured relationship was completely one-sided, as Charles would come to learn later that afternoon when Amanda and Sean came around for another visit.
We sat there and talked for, 20, 30 minutes, and he starts getting emotional, so I get up, because I was sitting on the couch together smoking cigarettes, he and I were, she doesn't smoke. But then she flops on the couch next to him.
The reason Charles had become so emotional was because the conversation had turned to Rex.
Just seeing him crying and like sobbing over it. Now I do remember, I wish I was with Rex. I was like, you wish you were with Rex.
And like I said, that's when the actual incident happened.
At that moment, Amanda looked at the clock. It was exactly 3:27 p.m., and just like she'd been planning for days, Amanda pulled the knife out Sean had just bought her and started stabbing Charles.
I killed Charlie at 3:27. I purposely did that because that's mine and Rex's day. I tried really hard to stab him in his chest. I know there's probably defense wounds. He put his arm up. I'm pretty sure I stabbed his face. I was mainly trying to stab his chest.
During the attack, Charles attempted to fight back, grabbing Amanda's hair and trying to get the knife from her. But as he did so, Sean pulled out a tire iron he'd hidden inside his pants and struck Charles in the head 5 or 6 times.
I think she stabbed him like 1 or 2 more times after he was still kind of like flinching, and she stabbed him a couple more times in the chest, like rammed it in pretty good, like right through the rib. Like one towards the heart.
After killing Charles, Amanda and Sean stole $220 from his wallet. They then hopped into Sean's Jeep and went on the run, but not before stopping at a sporting goods store to purchase ammunition for the guns they'd stolen the day before.
Where's your emergency?
We need an ambulance. I went in to turn the living room light on. I can see blood. I didn't touch him, but it don't appear that he's breathing.
It wasn't until later that evening when authorities in Montgomery County, Virginia, responded to a 911 call from the residence of Charles Taylor. When police arrived at the tiny, rundown home, they were stunned by the extreme brutality that had obviously occurred inside. There was blood everywhere, even on the walls and picture frames. Lying lifeless on a sofa was the body of Charles. He'd been stabbed 31 times. Even before receiving any extra information, investigators realized the motive for this homicide must have been deeply personal. There wasn't any doubt this was overkill. But the mystery of who committed this terrible crime wouldn't remain a secret for long. For starters, Charles' elderly father, who was now so frail he was confined to his upstairs bedroom, had recognized Amanda's voice He'd heard the whole thing. And if that wasn't enough, police on the scene were shell-shocked when they saw a photograph Amanda had just posted online. It was a selfie taken at the crime scene. In the picture, Amanda can be seen making her best selfie face, grinning through pursed lips, half smile, half duck face. In the photo, she's also proudly holding a very large knife, still dripping with blood, and in the background is the deceased body of Charles Taylor. Even while the police were looking at the photograph, they realized they were standing in the exact location it must have been taken. There was no doubt who'd committed the crime. The only thing they needed now was to catch her. But Amanda already had a head start. To their horror, police would soon realize Amanda would likely kill again. That night, Amanda and Sean drove to Tennessee, where they spent the night in a cheap motel. Amanda would later describe her feelings at this time as being extremely happy. She even went as far as to say it was the first time she felt alive since Rex's death. Amanda was excited about what she and Sean were planning to do next, something she referred to as Mickey and Mallory playtime. And she was thrilled about doing it with a person she believed was already an experienced killer. At 5:30 the next morning, Amanda posted to Facebook, "I proudly did this for Rex. I love my children, but Charlie killed my husband." As Sean and Amanda continued fleeing to North Carolina, they came up to a rest area where two teenage girls were sitting on a bench. Amanda believed it was the perfect opportunity to not only start their killing spree, but to steal the girls' car and stay one step ahead of the police. So Amanda handed Sean a pistol and told him it was time. That's when she realized Sean wasn't quite into this whole mass killing spree idea as he'd been pretending to be. When Sean told Amanda he couldn't go through with it, she was furious. Instead of stopping, Amanda took the wheel and continued driving, with Sean eventually falling asleep in the passenger seat, until he was suddenly startled awake by the sound of a gunshot. Dazed and confused, Sean saw that Amanda had stopped the car and tried shooting a woman jogging alongside the road. Not coincidentally, this was eerily reminiscent of a scene from Natural Born Killers, where Mallory shoots and kills a cyclist, saying, "I've always wanted to take a shot at one of them. They're not as easy to hit." After missing the jogger, Amanda decided to turn her attention to Sean, who hadn't turned out to be the partner in crime she'd envisioned. "Before you die," she said, "I want you to know that I only used you for your guns and your car." Then she raised up the gun and fired a bullet into his face. After driving off and leaving Sean for dead on the side of the road, Amanda made another post, this time to her Instagram account. "Everything I did was for the right reasons. I stabbed my father-in-law to death because he destroyed my husband with drugs. Sean's dead. If you keep looking for me, more will die." While Amanda was on the run, she used a series of burner phones to periodically contact friends and family members. By breaking the phones and throwing them away after each use, Amanda assumed police wouldn't be able to trace her calls. And she was half right. Police weren't able to trace the burner calls. But because Amanda couldn't seem to stay off social media during her escape, police were soon able to hone in on her location by tracking her smartphone. North Carolina police finally spotted Amanda driving down Interstate 40 and attempted to pull her over. Instead, Amanda hit the gas and a high-speed chase ensued. 2 miles later, the chase ended when Amanda ran over a series of spike strips police had placed in her way. Arrested on the spot, Amanda was charged with murder. She knew it was only a matter of time before they'd find Sean's body and another charge would be added to her name. Around 7 p.m. that same night, a passing motorist spotted Sean's body laying beside the road. He'd been shot in the jaw with a single bullet, but miraculously, he was still alive, but just barely.
All I remember at that point was like this most blinding pain like I've ever felt. Like, I don't know what happened. Like, I just remember, I didn't hear a gunshot or nothing. Like, I just went to the ground and felt like the most immense pain that I've ever felt. I don't know if she shot me once, shot me twice. I mean, I got three holes in me. I remember just being on my back on the ground and like just screaming. And then she drove off. I do remember that part, because like I said, I lost color in my sight, actually. Like, I don't know how to describe that. Like, I couldn't see anything hardly, but I remember her like waving goodbye to me, and she just drove off in my Jeep.
By the time Sean was taken to the hospital, he was in such bad shape, they placed him into a medically induced coma. But ultimately, he'd survive and make a full recovery. When Amanda was interrogated by police, she didn't hesitate to fully admit everything she'd done. From stabbing Charles, to the attempted murders of Sean Ball, as well as the unidentified innocent jogger. By openly admitting to everything, Amanda portrayed a chilling sense of control over the entire situation. She knew what she'd done and was proud of it. In fact, there wasn't an ounce of remorse in her voice. But police were still able to surprise Amanda with a bit of information she hadn't known.
You said he told you he was in the military?
Yeah, he said he was a Marine.
Okay.
Is that true?
No.
He was never, he never went to Afghanistan?
No.
Are you kidding me?
No, he was never in the military. He went to jail for a few years, but not in the military. Never been in the military.
He gave my son, like, all sorts of, like, stuff that apparently came from Afghanistan.
It turned out that Sean had been lying to Amanda the entire time. The truth was, Sean had attempted to enlist in the military once, but for whatever reasons, wasn't able to get in. In 2010, years before he met Amanda, Sean was arrested and charged with 24 counts of burglary and sentenced to 3 years in prison. Sean Ball would go on to plead guilty to the murder of Charles Taylor and received a 41-year prison sentence. Amanda chose to take her case to trial, and after less than 30 minutes of deliberation, a jury found her guilty. Throughout the trial, Amanda was often seen laughing and even smiled when a witness described the attack on Charles for the jury. Judging by her behavior, it appeared Amanda felt no remorse for any of her actions. Before being sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, the judge looked at Amanda and told her she was evil personified. The judge didn't buy Amanda's story that she'd murdered Charles Varex out of some misconstrued sense of justice or loyalty. Instead, the judge believed she'd done it for fame and the thrill of it. Any other explanation was just an excuse to justify her actions, a sentiment shared by Rex and Charles's family as well. Rex's mother would later say she chose to do what she'd done. My son did not tell her to do that. He was gone. My son may have done things we don't understand, may never understand, but my son was not a killer. He was not an evil person. Mariah Roebuck would also tell the Roanoke Times, I think she just wanted the fame that they were so fascinated by. As for Amanda and Rex's children, they've been lovingly raised by Amanda's mother since around the time of Rex's suicide, when Amanda's dark spiral into darkness began, and she could no longer take care of them herself. And now I'd like to introduce the podcast, Foul Play.
In a world where darkness lurks around every corner, one name stands out among the rest. The Zodiac.
We had a double homicide that took place last night. 16-year-old girl and a 17-year-old boy. A boy was shot right at the side of the car, and the girl apparently tried to run. We have no motive at this time.
His first words were, "I want to report a double murder. And I also killed those kids last year."
Step into the shadows with Foul Play Crime Series, chilling new season. Follow a predator who took the lives of 5 known victims, yet claimed a terrifying 37 across Northern California in the late 1960s. The Zodiac penned taunting, boastful letters and made disturbing phone calls.
"This is the Zodiac speaking."
Craving attention, he unveiled haunting confessions while toying with law enforcement over their failure to catch him.
"The police having a good time with the code."
Complex, intricate codes accompanied some of his letters, ciphers with hidden meaning that would take decades to break.
"I got a very taunting, creepy feeling from the call."
"It felt that the word kill or killing would appear in his code."
Listen to The Zodiac, releasing weekly, right now on Foul Play Crime Series.
Follow The Minds of Madness on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To support the show and get access to ad-free episodes, extra content, and Patreon-exclusive episodes, go to patreon.com/madnesspod. To find us on Instagram and Facebook, search The Minds of Madness, and on Twitter using the handle @MadnessPod. And also, by checking out our sponsors and using our promo codes, you're also helping support the show. We've got all the links in our episode notes. So until next week, thanks for listening.